Okay, so remember at the end of the last lecture, a long time ago, half an hour, I was telling you about the stabilizer for the 9-qubit code. So recall that the stabilizer here is, so here's a list of 8 things where if we measure all of this information, we'll know what the error syndrome is for the 9-qubit code, and that gives us the information we can use to correct one general error. So are there any questions on the first lecture, now that you've had more time to think about it? Yeah?
Could you, in theory, do all these measurements with one ancilla?
Yeah, I guess so. You could use the ancilla sequentially. But you want to get 8 bits of information out at the end, so you'll have to make 8 measurements, kind of one way or the other. Any other questions? Okay, so let's then go on. So what I'd like to do is kind of talk about the generalization of the stabilizer concept for quantum record encodes. And that will give us a mathematical framework that we can use to talk about more general quantum codes than this 9-qubit code. So in general, if I have some quantum error correcting code, you can define the stabilizer as a set of Pauli operators M for which the code words are all plus 1 eigenvectors. So M psi is equal to psi for all of the encoded state psi. Right? And I mean, of course, in general, you could define the stabilizer for kind of arbitrary operators, but because the Pauli group has some very nice properties, in particular, any pair of elements of the Pauli group commutes or anti-commute, I'm just going to restrict attention to the Pauli operators. And so the stabilizer will just be the set of Pauli operators that are plus one, have plus one eigenvector. Okay, so what properties does a stabilizer have to have? Well, first of all, it's a group. I mentioned that before, but here's the straightforward proof. So if m psi is equal to psi, and n psi is equal to psi, m and n are in the stabilizer of this code, then m times n psi, well, that's equal, n psi is equal to psi, so this is equal to m psi, which is again equal to psi. Right? So that means that mn is also in the stabilizer, right? Because it has plus one eigenvalue for all vectors psi. So stabilizer, closed under multiplication, these are Pauli operators, their inverses are plus or minus 1, so it's, the inverses are themselves, basically. It's closed under inverse, and it's a group. More than that, it's an abelian group. Everything in it commutes. Why is that? Well, if m psi is equal to psi, and n psi is equal to psi, then mn minus nm psi, well, mn psi is equal to psi, and m psi is equal to psi, so this difference here is equal to 0. Yeah? Yeah, yeah. So that's why I had put in parentheses. I didn't do the next line yet. So in general, this just means that mn minus nm psi commutes on some subspace of the psi. But Pauli matrices are special, and we're just dealing with Pauli matrices. And they either commute or anti-commute. If they anti-commuted, this wouldn't work at all. It would have no null space at all. But when they commute, then, of course, it does work. And so that's the only possibility for Pauli matrices here, that they actually commute. Okay? And basically, this is just saying that to have simultaneous eigenvectors of two different operators, they have to be commuting operators. And again, that's not generally true, but for the case of they have to commute on the relevant subspace. But and for Pauli matrices, that's enough. Okay, so we have an abelian group, and I guess another thing I didn't write down is it shouldn't contain minus 1, right, because the stabilizer is defined as things with plus 1 eigenvectors, and minus 1 has no plus 1 eigenvectors. So so if we have a stabilizer, then we know it's an abelian group without minus 1, and it's a subgroup of the Pauli group. And it turns out that if you have a group with those properties, an abelian subgroup of the Pauli operators without containing a minus 1, then we can go the other way. We can define a code subspace, which is going to be our quantum error correcting code. And we define it this way. So I'll call it T of S, and it's the set of vectors psi, which are plus 1 eigenvectors of every element of this group. Okay? So that's the, kind of the natural inverse. And so in for some subspaces, it's true that if you take the subspace, define its stabilizer, which again is a little bit tedious, but can be done, and then take this code space, you'll get back the original subspace. Okay? So in that case, it's called the subspace is called the stabilizer code. And that's not the most general quantum error correcting code. For some quantum error correcting codes, if you do this back and forth, you'll get something bigger than the original subspace. But I'm just going to concentrate on stabilizer codes. And stabilizer codes have nice properties because we can just deal with the stabilizer and use the group theoretic properties of the stabilizer to tell us interesting things about the code. Okay, so I'm not going to prove this, but you can show that if you're given such an abelian subgroup S, and you create the Hilbert space subspace that corresponds to S, G of S, then when S has n minus k generators, and you're acting on n qubits, then T of S encodes k qubits. So the whole Hilbert space is dimension 2 to the n, so T of S has dimension 2 to the k. Okay? And like I said, I'm not going to prove this, but it's very easy to remember. You can kind of get the idea by just thinking that each generator you add to the stabilizer, well, it's a Pauli operator, so it has eigenvalues plus and minus 1, and it cuts the space in half. Right? So you start with dimension 2 to the n, you add one generator, you're now down to 2 to the n minus 1 of things that have plus 1 eigenvalue for that operator. And then you add another operator, cuts the space in half again, so you're now down to size 2 to the n minus 2. And every independent operator you add to the stabilizer is going to cut the dimension in half again. And so when you add n minus k generators, you go from n down to k. Okay? Again, that's not a proof, because you have to see that each operator you're adding is kind of independent of each other, so it's really cutting the space in half. But that's conceptually what's going on. Okay, so from this little argument, well, from the corresponding proof, you can already see that looking at the stabilizer group is already telling us some interesting properties of the code, right? It's telling us the dimension of the encoded subspace. But of course, we'd like to do much more. We'd like to know about how good it is at correcting errors. So can we do that? Well, surely we can do something, right? Because in this nine-qubit code, we wrote down the stabilizer by thinking of what we had to measure in order to figure out where the errors were. And that can be totally generalized. So you remember, for the nine-qubit code, we measured the z-type operators to see where the bit flips were, the x errors were, and the x-type operators to see where the z errors were, right? So there's some pattern there, right? We measure one to detect errors of the other type. And x and z anti-commute. It turns out that's the crucial property. And it's very easy to prove that. So in particular, suppose we have m in the stabilizer, and psi is a code word, and we have some error e that anti-commutes with m. So what is e psi? Well, let's apply m to it. M e is equal to minus e m, because by we've defined them to anti-commute. And then we get m psi, which is equal to psi again, because m is in the stabilizer. So m e psi is equal to minus e psi. E psi is a minus 1 eigenvalue of m, where psi was a plus 1 eigenvalue, right? So if we start with a state in the code space, a plus 1 eigenvector of something in the stabilizer, and we have an error that anti-commutes with that element of the stabilizer, we go from the plus 1 eigenspace to the minus 1 eigenspace. So this is why measuring the eigenvalue of m can be used to detect the error e, right? If we have a plus 1 eigenvalue for m, we know, well, okay, let me do this one first, actually, before I say that. So suppose m and e commute. Well, in that case, m e psi is equal to e m psi, and m psi is equal to psi, so m e psi is equal to e psi. So if e commutes with m, we remain as a plus 1 eigenvector. If e anti-commutes with m, we go to a minus 1 eigenvector, right? So if we measure the eigenvalue of e, we know if the error that occurred is something that commutes with m or anti-commutes with m. Okay? Everyone understand that? Okay. So, in particular, suppose we define this set N of S, which is a normalizer in, well, it's, the definition here looks like a centralizer, but in the case of poly operators, it's the same. And stabilizer is the same. So N of S is going to be defined as the set of N in the poly group that commute with everything in the stabilizer. Okay? And by the argument on the last slide, the things in N of S are the things that leave the stabilizer, leave the code words as plus one eigenvectors of everything in the stabilizer. In other words, N of S is the things that take code words to code words. Right? Because the code space is defined as the set of plus one eigenvectors of everything in the stabilizer. Okay? So that means that if we have an error that's outside of N of S, well, then it's something we can detect by measuring the eigenvalues of the stabilizer, right? Because we started with all plus one eigenvalues, and after we have this anti-commuting error, at least one of the things in the stabilizer now has a minus one eigenvalue. Okay? So that suggests that the code should detect any error that's not in N of S. But if you look down here, I've actually written something more stringent. The code detects any error not in N of S minus S. Why is that? Well, suppose you had an error that's inside the stabilizer. It takes a code word to a code word. The stabilizer commutes, right? So S is always a subset of N of S. So if you have an error in the stabilizer, it takes a code word to a code word. But actually, it takes a code word to itself, right? That's how the stabilizer is defined. It's a set of things that take that for which the code words are plus one eigenvalues, eigenvectors. Yeah. Right now I'm just specializing to poly errors. There could be multiple cubic poly errors, but they're tensor products of I, X, Y, and Z. Okay? Right. And the reason I want to do that is because what I showed you in last time is that if you correct the poly errors, that's enough. That everything else can be written as a superposition. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. So we have two possibilities, right? For correcting an error, or for detecting an error. So if the error is outside N of S, then that's fine. We can measure an eigenvalue and see that the error has happened. If the error is inside S, it actually takes the code word to itself. So it's not really an error, right? It's the identity. It acts like the identity. Even if it's a non-trivial operator on the rest of the Hilbert space, on the code space, it's trivial. Okay? So we don't need to think of it as an error. We can think of it as the identity. And therefore, the set of bad things, the set of errors that take code words to different code words, at least some code words go to different code words, is this set N of S minus S. Okay? That's a set of undetectable errors. Okay? So based on that, we define a distance of this code space as the minimum weight of a poly operator in N of S minus S. Right? So the distance is the smallest number of qubits we have to act on to take one code word to a different code word. And so that's the smallest error that we can't detect with this code. Okay? So the fact that we have this minus S here is really a big difference from classical codes. It means that sometimes we have codes where there's a very small weight thing in the stabilizer, but N of S actually, N of S minus S actually has only bigger weight things. So we call that a degenerate quantum error correcting code in the case where S contains, well, S always contains the identity, but if it contains a non-trivial operator with weight less than the distance of the code is called degenerate. And if that doesn't happen, then it's non-degenerate. Yeah. Why do we call this distance? Well, so it's first of all, there's a very similar definition for classical error correction, which I'll get to in a minute, or in a few minutes. But it's related to this. So the classical concept is related to the Hamming distance, which is if you have a string of bits how many bits you have to flip to get from the first string to the second string. Okay? And that's the distance between the two strings. So similarly, this is the distance between two different code words, kind of the minimum over all code words of the distance between code words. The minimum number of qubits you have to act on to get from one code word, the first code word, to the second code word. Any other questions? Okay. So how do we leverage this into correcting errors? Well, it turns out that if you have a stabilizer code with distance d, it'll correct d minus 1 over 2 errors, rounded down. Why is that? Well, so what this means is that if we want to correct t errors, we should have a code with distance 2t plus 1. So how does this distance definition and these detectable errors connect to correcting errors? Well, every generator of the stabilizer we measure, every time we measure an element of the stabilizer, we'll get some information about what the error is, right? We'll see if the error is something that commutes with that element of the stabilizer or anti-commutes. And so our goal is to measure enough things, as in this case, to completely identify what the error is. Turns out we're not always going to be able to do that, but let's start with that, okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to measure one generator stabilizer after another, and each time we get more information about what the error is. And when we put together all these eigenvalues, that's the error symptom, right? And so we want to say that two errors are distinguishable if they have different error symptoms, right? So if every error has a unique error syndrome, then we're happy. Every possible error has a unique error syndrome, then we're happy, because then we can uniquely look at the error syndrome and uniquely identify what the error is. So when do two errors have the same error syndrome? Well, they have the same error syndrome if and only if they commute with the same elements of the stabilizer, right? Because that's what the error syndrome is. It tells us which elements of the stabilizer they commute with and which ones they anti-commute with, okay? And if two errors commute with the same elements of the stabilizer, then it means that E dagger F commutes with everything in the stabilizer. Why is that? Well, E and F commute with the same things, so if you move F past M and E past M, you'll get either 2 plus 1s or 2 minus 1s, right? So E dagger F will automatically commute with everything in the stabilizer when E and F have the same error syndrome. Conversely, if E and F don't have the same error syndrome, well, then there's some M for which E commutes and F anti-commutes, or vice versa. And in that case, E dagger F will anti-commute with that M. So E dagger F is in this set N of S if and only if E and F have the same error syndrome. Okay? So by looking at products of pairs of errors and seeing whether they're in N of S or not, we can find out about whether the error syndromes are all different. And if the error syndromes, if no two of the error syndromes are the same, remember, then we're set. Then we can identify the error and correct it. Okay? So if for all possible pairs of errors, E dagger F is not in N of S, then we're good. Then we can correct all the errors. But there's another case, right? What happens if E dagger F is actually not only in N of S, but it's actually in S? Well, in that case, we can't distinguish these two errors, right? Because it's in N of S. They have the same error syndrome. But it turns out we don't need to, right? Because if E dagger F is in S, that means E dagger F psi is equal to psi, which means that E psi is equal to F psi. So E and F, they're different errors, but on the code space, they do the same thing, right? So we don't need to distinguish them. So you can see an example of that for the 9-qubit code. So this is why this is called the degenerate code when we use this minus S condition. So in the 9-qubit code, well, 9-qubit code corrects one error, and what that's going to mean is it has distance 3. But looking at the stabilizer here, you can see that it has some weight 2 operators in it, right? So it's a degenerate code. And that manifests itself by saying that there's pairs of errors that do the same thing to the code space. Well, what are those pairs? Well, like, for instance, Z1, Z2. If you have a phase error on the first qubit, it does the same as a phase error on a second qubit, right? If you have 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, a phase error on the first qubit will take it to 0, 0, 0 minus 1, 1, 1. As will a phase error on the second qubit, or for that matter, a phase error on the third qubit. Okay? So phase errors on the first, second, and third qubits, you can't tell which one occurred. But you don't need to, because they give you the same state. And so if you're wrong, and you think it was a phase error on the first qubit, when it's actually a phase error on the second qubit, well, it doesn't matter, because you'll correct it in the same way. Okay? So if we have two errors whose product, like this, is in the stabilizer, E dagger F is in the stabilizer, then we don't need to distinguish them. So that's okay, too. So that's the overall condition. We look at all pairs E and F, and if E dagger F is always outside this bad set, this undetectable set, N of S minus S, then we have a good quantum error correcting code that corrects the set of possible errors. Okay? So how does that connect to this statement up at the top? Well, suppose we have a code of distance D, which is equal to 2t plus 1, and we want to correct errors of weight t. All possible errors of weight t. Well, again, it's enough to look at all possible Pauli errors of weight t. And we should look at pairs of them, right? And products of pairs of errors of weight t are things of weight 2t, up to 2t. They could be less. And we know, if the code has distance 2t plus 1, that everything in N of S minus S has weight at least 2t plus 1. So anything of weight 2t must be outside of it. Okay? So that's why a code of distance 2t plus 1 corrects t errors. Has everyone got that? Other questions on that? Yeah. Right. Right. So that seems like it would be a very good case, right, where N of S is equal to S. But it turns out that so if you have if S has size 2 to the N minus K, then N of S, because of the properties of the Pauli group, always has size 2 to the N plus K. Okay? So the only case where N of S is equal to S is when K is equal to 0. So there's no encoded qubits. So it seems very good, but it turns out it only is possible when the stabilizer code is kind of trivial. It's not really trivial. There's a single state that satisfies like a stabilizer code, but it's not enough to encode any information. Any other questions? Yeah. Right. So, here's the argument in short. The point is that by pairing the errors together, we can tell whether their syndromes are the same or different, whether we can distinguish them by measuring the generator of the stabilizer. And so we can just look at this set N of S. Okay? Any other questions?
So that's
one strategy, but of course that means that K is going to be smaller and smaller based on what I told you, right?
Yeah.
So what you really like to do is design it very cleverly so that N of S is very big, but somehow it has no low weight things in it. Okay, that's hard to do in general, but in some cases you can manage it. Any other questions? Yeah.
So in the pair of errors, suppose I choose F to be, say, the identity of number. So meaning that, say there is no error. Then I know that E dagger F is kind of like, suppose that no, it is F minus F. So I know that E dagger, so I know that E, so that I know that E is not the identity, so I know there's an error.
Right.
And
so
saying that I can know that.
No. So, sorry. So, I mean, so what you do is you take your set of all possible errors, and you should include the identity as a possible error, because it's possible there could be nothing that happened. It would be embarrassing if you had this big thing and there was no error and then you didn't know that, so you messed it up. So you include the identity as a possible error, and you look at all pairs. So yes, you could let F be the identity. And what that means is that all of the errors in your set should also be outside N of S minus S. But that's not enough. You need more. And so that's why you have to look at the pairs. But because the identity is a possible error, this product of pairs includes the original set. It just includes other things, too. Was that addressing the right question? Yes and no. So the code can be kind of operated in two different ways. So one of them is to say, I just want to detect errors. Okay? And in that case, you generally can't tell what error has occurred, but at least you know when there's an error and when there isn't an error. The other way is to say, I want to correct errors. And in that case, you kind of give up some of your capability to detect errors, right? So suppose we have a distance 3 code, okay? So that means we can correct one error, right? If t is 1, then we need a distance 3 code to correct one error. So if we look at the error syndrome, we say, oh, this error corresponds to this 1-qubit error. But if there was actually a 2-qubit error, well, it's a distance 3 code, so it might be that there's a 1-qubit error that has the same error syndrome as this 2-qubit error, right? And then the product of these things has a weight 3, which could be an N of S minus S. Okay, so in that case, we'd have a problem. We were correcting 1-qubit errors, but there was actually a 2-qubit error, and we mistake it for a 1-qubit error. But we could use this code to detect 2-qubit errors without any trouble, because this 2-qubit error will always have to have a non-trivial error syndrome, because it anti-commutes with something. Okay? So you can also do somewhere in between where you correct some errors. If you have a code of high distance, you can correct some errors and detect some additional ones.
So in general, you can detect more than you can correct.
In general, yes. And but if you want to combine both of them, you have to be a little bit careful. Any other questions? Okay. So let's look at a specific example of a code. So that 9-qubit code, well, it's good. It corrects one general error, but here, I guess we don't need it anymore. So it corrects one general error, but it's kind of inefficient, right? To correct, classically, we could encode one bit in 3 bits and still correct one error. Going 1 bit to 9 bits, that's kind of a lot. So it turns out we can do much better, although not as good as classically. And there's a 5-qubit code that will correct one general error. So here it is. And we can write it in the stabilizer formalism. So the one nice thing is that if you were to actually write out the code words for this 9-qubit code, they're starting to get a little clunky. Here I have 4 operators for the stabilizer. These are the generators of the stabilizer. We don't have to write out the whole stabilizer, right? It's anything that's the product of these things is also in the stabilizer. And by the argument I had before, we have 5 physical qubits and 4 generators, so there's 1 encoded qubit. Okay? And if you write out the code words, well, there are 2 of them, and it turns out that each of them is a superposition over 16 different things. Okay? 16 different 5-bit strings. So this is already saving a little bit in terms of representing the code space. And it gets much better as you go to bigger codes. If you have codes that encode a lot of qubits or use a lot of qubits, for that matter, the representation in terms of writing out the basis states is exponential in N, whereas the stabilizer thing is only quadratic in N, right? Because you have to, well, it's N along here and N minus K generators here. Okay? So that's a big improvement. The other thing is that by looking at this, you can very rapidly tell, well, okay, maybe not very rapidly, but you can tell fairly efficiently what errors it can correct. And that's just using the condition I told you about on the last slide. So in particular, if you figure out the distance of the code, that'll tell you how many things you can correct. This 5-qubit code, it turns out, has distance 3. So I'll let you check that for yourself. So there's two ways to do that, right? One of them is to take a 2-qubit poly operator, take an arbitrary 2-qubit poly operator, and make sure that it anti-commutes with something in the stabilizer. So for instance, if you have Y3, Y4, so 2Y errors on the third and fourth qubits, well, Y3, Y4 will commute with the first thing because Z and Y anti-commute, but X and Y also anti-commute, so we get 2 minus 1. It'll commute with the second thing, it'll commute with the third thing, but it anti-commutes with the fourth operator here, because Y commutes with I, even though and Y anti-commutes with X. Okay? The other way to do this is to look at all 1-qubit operators, poly operators, and see that they all have different error syndromes. You can do that too. In fact, it turns out in this case that, well, there's 5 qubits, and each qubit, the 1-qubit error could be X, Y, or Z. So it's 15 possible errors, plus the identity is 16 possible errors. And there's 16 possible error syndromes, right? Because you have plus or minus 1 for each generator. And this is a non-degenerate code, and each error uses up exactly 1 error syndrome, so all the error syndromes get used up. So that argument that I could give you is not a proof that this is the best quantum error correction code, because you could have potentially a degenerate code that does better. But it turns out it is the best quantum error correcting code that corrects 1 error. There's a simple argument using the no-cloning theorem that shows that, but I won't get into it. Okay? So when we talk about quantum error correcting codes, we like to use this double bracket notation. So classical error correcting codes, they usually use single brackets. So the double bracket distinguishes a quantum code. And we list 3 numbers in this double bracket. So the first one is the number of qubits, physical qubits used in the code. The second one is the number of logical qubits, the number of encoded qubits for the code. And then the third number is the distance of the code. So these are kind of the 3 most important properties of the code. And you can derive them all from looking at the stabilizer. Okay, so this 5-qubit code is a 513 code. The 9-qubit code was a 913 code. Okay? Any questions about that? That's right. That's right. Okay, so there's a couple of uses. So first of all, sometimes it's enough just to say, well, I have this quantum state. I would like it to come out correct, but if it's not correct, at least I'd like to know that there's a problem. And then if there's a problem, I'll do something else. Okay? So in that case, detecting an error is already giving you some information. It also turns out that a distance D code, it can detect D minus 1 errors, but it can also correct a different class of errors called erasure errors. So if you have errors of the form where some qubits get messed up, you don't know ahead of time which ones are going to get messed up, but after it happens, you know that they were messed up. You just don't know what happened to them. So that's called an erasure error. And it turns out a distance D code can also correct D minus 1 erasure errors. So distance D code can correct 1 erasure error. So for instance, an example of an erasure error is each qubit is a photon. You send the photons through an optical fiber, and one of them doesn't come out. So you can, in principle, see that it didn't come out. And so you know that there's an error there, because there's no photon. But you don't know what it originally was. So that's an example of an erasure error. And a distance 2 code is enough to correct that. Right. So so one way to do that. So remember, the code words are going to be a little unwieldy, but the best way to do that is to find the projector on the code subspace. And we can do that by taking the product of the projectors on the plus one eigenvectors of each of these operators. So remember, we have generators here, M1, M2, M3, M4. So those are the four things that I've written there. And this 1/2 I plus M1 is a projector on the plus one eigenspace of M1. Okay? And in general, 1/2 plus MI, sorry, 1/2 times I plus MI is a projector on the plus one eigenspace of MI. Okay? So what we want to do is we want to take the product over that. Sorry, I didn't. So the product over I of this thing is the projector on the code space. So based on this projector, you can write down two basis code words. So for instance, if you apply this to the state all zeros, you get the encoded zero state. And if you apply it to the state all ones, you get the encoded one state. So there's another nice way of writing this, which is 1 over 2 to the n minus k times the sum over m and the stabilizer of m. So it's just a simple exercise to see that these two things are the same. Yeah. Sorry, the codes that have small distance are bad codes? Yeah, that's the true for stabilizer code. That the distance encapsulates, you know, with a factor of 2, how many errors you can correct. So you want a code that has a big distance. On the other hand, you also want a code that encodes a lot of qubits, right? So ideally, you'd like both k and d to be big, but in practice, that you can't do that, right? There's a trade-off between the two. And it's just the same as in classical error correction. Other questions? Okay, so actually, in that case, I'd like to move on to talking about classical codes, which is kind of backwards, I know. We talked about quantum codes first and then classical codes. But from the point of view of quantum error correction, classical error correcting codes are mostly useful as inspirations to help build quantum error correcting codes. So I'm going to tell you now about a construction that takes some classical error correcting codes and uses them to make quantum codes. But to do that, I imagine not all of you are familiar with classical error correcting codes, so I'm going to give you a short introduction first. So in particular, I'm going to deal with the family of classical linear codes. So classical linear code is defined, or can be defined in any case, using something called the parity check matrix. Okay? So the parity check matrix, so a classical code is a set of vectors, but now I'm thinking of them, these vectors, in a binary vector space. So it's a set of bit strings, and the algebraic operation of adding these bit strings together is taking each coordinate and adding them mod 2. Okay. So I'm going to define these linear codes in terms of this parity check matrix, which is an n minus k by n binary matrix, and the set of code words is defined as the null space of this matrix. So it's a set of V such that HV is equal to 0. Okay? And what this means is that each row of the parity check matrix is some condition that the code words have to satisfy. Right? So if you unpack this equation, you'll see that what it's saying is that if you look at the row, at a particular row, and you take the bits where that row has a 1, then the parity of those bits in the vector should be even. Okay? Because basically this is just saying that the vector representing the row dotted with the vector v should be 0. Okay? Which means that there has to be an even number of 1s in the place where that row has 1. Okay. So, the reason this is called a classical linear a linear code is because if V and W are both in C, then it follows that V plus W is in C, right? And that's very easy to see. You apply H to V plus W, And H is a linear, is a matrix, it's a linear operator. So that means that H times V plus W is equal to HV plus HW, which is 0 plus 0. So V plus W is, again, in the null space of H. Okay, so the code is closed under binary linear operations. That's why it's called a linear code. Okay, and so the distance of this classical code is defined in kind of a similar way to the distance of a stabilizer code as the smallest non-zero vector, the weight of the smallest non-zero vector that's in the code. Okay. So if you work it out, that's closely related to the definition that I just gave you. I'll tell you the correspondence between classical linear codes and stabilizer codes in a minute. So let's just take this definition for granted. And the advantage of this definition is that you can define an error syndrome to be, so if you have an arbitrary vector E, find the error syndrome of E to be H acting on E, right? And then the code words, they have zero error syndrome, as is sensible, right? They have no errors. But if you have V plus E, so E has, you know, ones in certain places, and V plus E takes the original vector and flips the bits in the places where E has a one. And then H applied to V plus E is HV, which is 0, plus HE. So V plus E has the same error syndrome as the vector E. And two things, E and F, only have the same error syndrome. HE is equal to HF only if E plus F is in C. Right? This is binary, so plus and minus are the same. Okay? Everyone see that? So what this means is that you can apply the same argument we had before, that if we have a code of distance 2t plus 1, then we correct t errors. Because if e is weight t and f is weight t, then e plus f is weight at most 2t. And we know e plus f can't be in C unless e plus f is equal to 0. Because C has no non-zero vector of weight less than 2t plus 1. Okay? And if e plus f equals 0, that means e and f are the same. So you don't really expect them to have different error syndromes. Right, so here's the vector, and it's still kind of an operator you apply, it's just that adding the vector E to the original vector V flips, yeah. Oh, yeah, I said that, but it's not written. Right, but it turns out there's kind of a mapping to the bit flip errors in the quantum case. Okay? So this is classical linear coding. So what is the connection? Oh, sorry. Here's an example of a classical linear code. Well, you've already seen one example. The repetition code is an example. But here's a more non-trivial example. So this is one of the classical Hamming codes, 7-bit Hamming code. And so here's the parity check matrix. So this first row says that, so 7 bits, so the code words should be 7 bits long. And the first row says that the first 4 bits of the code word should have even parity. Second one says the first, second, fifth, and sixth bits should together have even parity. And this one says the first, third, fifth, and seventh bits should together have even parity. So there's a lot of possible code words that satisfy that. In fact, the number that satisfy is exactly... So there's 3 rows here, and columns of all the... Yeah, okay. Sorry, this is something about general Hamming codes. But there's 3 rows here, and it turns out that means that there's kind of 4 independent vectors that will satisfy these conditions. And you can take sums of those vectors, too. So we'll have 2 to the 4 or 16 possible vectors in this Hamming code, including the all zeros vector, which certainly satisfies it. Okay? The other thing is that this code has distance 3. So why is that? Well, each of the columns in this priority check matrix is different. And none of them is zero. So if you have an error of weight 1, it will have odd parity for any of these things that has a 1 in the appropriate place. Right? So for instance, a 1 in the third place will give you odd parity for the first and third rows. Right? So if you look at the error syndrome, H applied to E, well, in the case where E is the third, is 1 on the third bit, it'll have error syndrome 1, 0, 1. The error syndrome is just the column of this parity check matrix. Okay? And that shows you that all the 1-bit errors have different non-trivial error syndromes, because all the columns are different. And then the 0 vector has error syndrome 0. So any 1-bit error will have a different error syndrome, and this code will correct one error. So it has distance 3. Okay? And you can generalize that construction by saying, well, let's take R rows, and we'll make all the columns different. Well, there's going to be 2 to the R minus 1 possible columns, so that's N. And D is going to be 3. And then how many encoded bits will we have? Well, each row that we take will decrease the number of logical bits by 1, just as we had in the stabilizer case. So the number of encoded bits is going to be 2 to the R minus R minus 1. Okay? And so the specific case for R equals 3, we have a 743 code. And again, it's the same notation as in the quantum case. The single bracket indicates a classical linear code. First one is the number of logical, physical bits, the second is the number of logical bits, and the third is the distance. Okay? Okay, so what's the connection with quantum codes? Well, basically, a classical linear code is a special case of a stabilizer code. So in particular, if you take the parity check matrix and replace all the 1s with z's and the 0s with i's, we get a stabilizer code. Okay? So each row is going to correspond to one generator of the stabilizer. And you see in the... So this first row of the Hamming code had 1s in the first 4 places, and this has z's in the first 4 places. And this says, well, we have a plus 1 eigenvector, remember, when these 4 bits have even parity, which is just what we wanted for the Hamming code. And similarly for this row and this row. Okay? So this stabilizer defines a subspace of the Hilbert space. It's now quantum, but it defines a subspace whose basis is just the classical code words. Okay? So really, this is the same code. And what that means is if you use this on a superposition of states, it'll work just by linearity the same as the classical code, and it'll correct 1-bit flip error on such things. Of course, it doesn't correct any phase errors. It's just a classical code. But it works on superpositions, at least. Okay? By x. Right. So suppose you replace the ones here by x's instead. What do you get? Well, then you get a code that corrects one phase error. Right? It's still a stabilizer code. So now, to kind of see the relationship with the classical code, you have to go to the Hadamard basis. But if you look in the plus-minus basis, then again, the basis for the subspace defined by the x version of this code will be the classical code word. And in fact, that's the key to what we want to do next. What we want to do is we want to make a real quantum code that corrects... So this thing just corrects 1-bit flip error, but not any phase errors. If we use x's instead, that would correct one phase error and not 1-bit flip error. We want to do both at once, so we'll make a stabilizer that has one block where we replace the 1s by z's and a second block where we replace the 1s by x's. Okay? So if we have a bit flip error, we can detect it by looking at the error syndrome, the first 3 bits of the error syndrome. If we have a phase error, we can detect it by looking at and identify where it is by looking at these 3 generators. If we have a Y error, well, it'll show up in both places. So we can distinguish the Y errors from the X and Z errors. Okay? So is everyone happy with that? That was a trick question. You're not supposed to be happy with that. There's something else we need to check. What is it? Louder? A billion. Yeah, we have to check that it's a billion group, right? We can't just throw any operators together and say, oh, we have a stabilizer code. It has to be in a billion group. Now, on this last slide, that was okay. The Z's always commute with each other. So we can always do this. But when we put the Z's and the X's together, we have to be more careful. But you can check, in fact, that this is in a billion group. So, for instance, this operator here commutes with this here, right? Because there's two places where you have both a Z and an X. The X and the I commute, the Z and the I commute. And if you look at all pairs between the top three and the bottom three, it turns out they all commute. So this is good. So in this case, we've taken two copies of the Hamming code and put them together to get a six-generator stabilizer code. We had seven physical qubits. That means we have one logical qubit left over. And we corrected one general bit flip error, one phase error, so it has distance 3. Okay? So it's the 713 quantum error correcting code. Okay? Now, in general, this C1 and C2 that we used here didn't have to be the same, but we do need some consistency condition to make sure that it's in a billion group. So what is that? Well, we can see what it is by thinking about the dual of this classical code. So the dual C perp is defined as the set of vectors W such that V dot W is equal to 0 for all V in the original code C. Okay? So this is related to the parity check condition. Because remember the parity check, the linear code was defined as a set of vectors that were orthogonal to rows of the parity check matrix. So in fact, the rows of the parity check matrix will be kind of the basis vectors for this C perp, the dual code. Okay. So, furthermore, if you take one vector V and replace the ones by X's, and another vector W and replace the ones by Z's, well, V and W will commute if and only if V dot W is equal to 0. Why is that? Well, V dot W counts the number of places where both vectors are 1, right? So we have a Z for one of them and an X for the other. And we're doing binary arithmetic, so it's 0 if there's an even number of those places. So if there's an even number of places where we have an X and a Z, we get an even number of minus 1s when we try to move one past the other. That's when they commute. If it's an odd number, if V dot W is equal to 1, then they anti-commute. Okay? So what we want to do is we want to take... Here. What we want to do is we want to take one operator from C1 and compare it to an operator from C2 and see if they commute, right? Because one of them is Z's and one of them is X's. So we have V from C1 perp and W from C2 perp, because these are rows of the parity check matrix. And they commute if and only if V dot W equals 0. Okay? So that means that W is actually an element of C1 perp perp, right? Because this should be true for everything in C1 perp, for every row of this first parity check matrix. So C1 perp perp turns out is just C1 again. So this is saying that any W in C2 perp has to be an element of C1. So C2 perp has to be a subset of P1, of C1. It didn't really matter which was C1 and C2. This is equivalent to saying that C1 perp is a subset of C2. But this is the right condition. So if we have an arbitrary classical pair of classical linear codes that satisfies that C2 perp is a subset of C1, we can put them together, turn one of them into a bit flip correcting code, one of them into a phase flip correcting code, and we'll get a quantum error correcting code. So this construction is called the CSS construction, after its inventors, Calder, Banks, Shor, and Steen. And it's a really great way of making codes, because there's a lot of classical linear codes known. We can use it to make quantum codes. So what properties do those quantum codes have? What are the basic parameters? Well, suppose C1 is an NK1D1 code. C2 is an NK2D2 code. They should have the same number of physical bits involved in them, because this construction needs everything to line up there. So the number of physical qubits we get out is certainly N. How many logical qubits do we get out? Well, The first code had n minus k1 rows for its parity check matrix. Those become generators of the stabilizer. The second one had n minus k2 rows of its parity check matrix. Those become generators of the stabilizer. So, so all in all, we have n minus k1 plus n minus k2 generators of the stabilizer. And so the number of encoded qubits is n minus this, right? So that's k1 plus k2 minus n. That's what I have here. Okay, so that's the number of logical qubits in the stabilizer code. Obviously, if k1 and k2 are kind of small, this could be less than zero. So in that case, it's just not going to work. It turns out in that case, it's not possible that the dual of one code is included in the other. Okay, so what's the third parameter, the distance? Well, C1 is going to be used to correct bit flip errors. And we know it can correct bit flip errors up to distance D1. C2 is going to correct phase flip errors. And it can correct phase flip errors up to D2, distance D2. Right? And if you have a Y error, well, that'll get picked up in both. So what's the distance of the quantum code? Well, it should be at least the minimum of D1 and D2. Right? It can't really be smaller than the minimum because, well, I mean, obviously, if there's fewer errors, we'll still be able to deal with them. But, sorry, the point is that if there's a phase error that's less than this size, then we can correct it using this code, and a bit flip error will detect it, and a bit flip error we can detect it using this code. So we should really take the minimum of these two because we want to take the worst case of bit flip versus phase errors. Okay? But I put here greater than or equal to. Does anyone know why? Well, but why can I do that? I mean, so suppose you had an error that's bigger than D1 or D2. Right? Suppose it's just I had a bit flip error that's bigger than D1, right? So I, for D prime, I should be able to correct all quantum errors, no matter whether bit flip phase or some combination. Suppose I had a bit flip error that's bigger than D1, and C1 corrects bit flip errors. Then that seems like it could be a problem, right? Because C1 can't correct errors or can't detect errors that are that big. So is it ever possible that D prime could be greater than the minimum of these two? Well, I put this greater than or equal to because it is possible, and I want. And why is it possible?
Because we take the minimum of C1 and C1 orthogonal minus C1 minus C1 orthogonal and C2 minus C2 orthogonal minus C2.
Right. So okay. So the reason we're taking the minus there. It's because of the special quantum code property of degenerate codes, right? So, in this, in when we were back here and converting the parity check code to a stabilizer code, the distance was defined as just the minimum non-zero vector that commutes with this. Okay, but for stabilizer code, it's the minimum non-zero vector is the minimum vector that commutes with this. That's not in the stabilizer, okay? And so, for instance, the 9-qubit code is actually a CSS code, but one of the codes is distance 2. Nevertheless, the code, the quantum code, is distance 3. Okay, I'll let you think about that yourself. But the upside is that if you have a degenerate quantum code, the distance might be greater than you expect just by looking at the minimum of these two distances. Okay. And so, the very last thing I want to say is. What the code words of these CSS codes look like. So it turns out that you can write the code words as a superposition over classical code words. And in particular, remember that we have C2 perp is a subset of C1. So the code words are going to correspond to cosets of C2 perp in C1. So if let's just take V to be some kind of arbitrary element of C1. And then the code word that corresponds to, the logical quantum code word that it corresponds to, is the superposition over W in C2 perp of V plus W. So it's a superposition of a whole bunch of classical code words. And of course, if V minus V prime is in C2 perp, then these things are the same because, well, the you just get a different order of the things in this coset. But if they're in different cosets, then we get different code words. And if you plug the numbers, it all turns out correctly to be all the code words. Okay, so so that's all I wanted to say. Then the next talk, Panos Alaferis will start to tell you about how to do fault-tolerant quantum computation, which is how to take these quantum error-correcting codes and generalize them to work even if the encoding circuits you're using are not working perfectly, and the error-correcting circuits and so on are not working perfectly. But these quantum error-correcting codes are still useful on their own. For instance, if you want to do communications or memory, and you have pretty good gates, so you can get a pretty good encoding, and then you wait a while or send it over a channel, and there's some errors, and then you have pretty good decoding to correct those errors. This theory of stabilizer codes covers a wide class of codes, including these CSS codes. But, of course, there's quantum error-correcting codes that I haven't talked about that don't fall into that family. They're more difficult to deal with, but sometimes they're still useful. So, anyway, to summarize in a different form, I have a quantum error-correcting sonnet for you. We cannot clone perforce. Instead, we split coherence to protect it from that wrong that would destroy our valued quantum bit and make our computation take too long. Correct a flip in phase. That will suffice. If in our code another error is bred, we simply measure it. Then God plays dice, collapsing it to X or Y or Z. We start with noisy 7, 9, or 5, and end with perfect 1. To better spot those flaws we must avoid, we first must strive to find which ones commute and which do not. With group and eigenstate, we've learned to fix your quantum errors with our quantum tricks.